Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Labyrinth in the News. Today is the 22nd day of the Solar Jaguar Moon of Intention, Dali, Crown Chakra, Red Lunar Moon Day. The affirmation is, I polarize in order to purify, stabilizing flow. I seal the process of universal water with the lunar tone of challenge. I am guided by the power of birth. It's also Gregorian calendar Sunday, March 28th, 2010. I'm your host, Christiana, coming to you live from the Couve. That's Vancouver, Washington, across the river from Portland, Oregon, as I will be doing usually every Monday at 3:30 p.m. My lead-in music is the first cut, Icos, short for icosahedron, the water symbol in sacred geometry, off of Susan Alexander's CD, Sequentia. If any of you would like to chat while we're on the air, please go to christiana-anea@blogtalkradio.com. My guest today is Ariana Rain, author of a book about labyrinths that's just gone into print and member of a team that created a fully accessible labyrinth for people with disabilities. Thank you, Ariana, for joining me today. Ariana, hi.
Hi.
Thank you for joining me today.
You're very welcome. Nice to be with you.
Well, I just want to congratulations on your books going into print. That's very exciting. What's the name of the book, and can you tell us a bit about what it's about?
Yeah, the name of the book is Labyrinths of British Columbia, A Guide for Your Journey. And it's actually the second edition. About just over a year ago, I came out with a small, concise guide, that I had published myself. And it met with such an incredible success, it totally surprised me and delighted me. And a local bookseller in Victoria told me that, you know, you should really think of doing this in a much more formal manner. And so over the last year, that's what I've been doing. And so I'm very excited that this week it's, you know, actually going to be printing.
Is it a local or a Canadian printing company?
Yes, it is. It's in Victoria. And it's the book itself, really, it's a guidebook to labyrinths in British Columbia. And so there are about 110. I say about because, you know, there are a couple that are being built as we speak, and some projects that are going on, a little bit of history and background on labyrinths and how people have been using them. And so it's, and then I have a section on BC artists.
Okay. And compared to that, the first print, the first edition that you did, that was pretty much sort of fly by the seat of your pants, it sounds like. Well, how many more labyrinths are in this second edition, and is this is a much more polished adventure?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. That was my intention, was to, you know, make it more polished, more a book. The previous one had, it was like a double, what do they call that? It's not a coil-bound thing, but it's a double ring sort of thing, and booksellers don't really like to have those books on the shelf. Makes it very difficult to market them. So one of my intentions was to make it conforming to what works actually in a bookstore. And so, yeah, I had 75 labyrinths in the first edition, and now, as I said, I have around 110. Some of the ones that were in the original edition have gone by the way. They've either, you know, they're not in existence anymore, or that I've just, you know, been focusing on more established labyrinths.
And this is only in British Columbia, though, not the rest of Canada or any other area of Canada.
Right. Yeah, it's only in British Columbia. And that was enough, let me tell you.
Well, so what motivated you to go to do this in the first place?
I was using labyrinths, actually. I had been presenting workshops on personal development. And it started when I learned about labyrinths, which was about 12 years ago now. I was living in Vancouver, and a friend introduced me to the one at St. Paul's Labyrinth, which I think is the first one in Canada to be indoors. And Lauren Artress was actually instrumental, I think, in that being built. Painted on the floor and inside. But it was very close to where I lived, and so I was doing, because I was presenting workshops at the time, I started to see how I could use the labyrinth, you know, as part of my workshops. And so I started actually presenting my workshops at the church and incorporating the use of the labyrinth in it. So over time, people started, you know, just inquiring more about would I do a workshop here and there, would I build them a labyrinth and do a workshop at their retreat center. And then when I moved to Victoria several years ago, I found that I was getting a lot of calls and emails from people who just wanted to know where the labyrinths were. And that just became quite a job, you know, making lists and emailing. So the first guide kind of came about as something I needed to do just to organize myself and also be able to just, you know, give that material to other people. So I thought, oh, you know, there's a real need for this. So I'll get my organization together and actually put it out.
How difficult was it to locate and get access to all the labyrinths listed in your guide?
Oh, not hard at all, actually. I mean, the trouble is, you know, sort of stopping the flood because it was all word of mouth. One person led me to another, and every few days I hear about a new one. And, you know, and then, of course, I investigate them to find out whether they are open to having people actually coming into their property, you know, because a lot of them are at private homes. And so it's, you know, I've been kind of blown away by how generous everyone has been and how forthcoming about, and I realized in that journey that, you know, people might think that they built the labyrinth for themselves and for their family or, you know, for a specific purpose. And truly, they have built them for everyone. You know, they really do want other people to find them and to use them.
And did you actually visit every single one that's in the book?
No, I didn't. At first I thought I had to do that, and then I realized, oh, no, this is turning into a much bigger job than I realized. I think I've seen probably half of them, mostly on the coast and on Vancouver Island, on the Gulf Islands, which are, you know, all the little islands between Vancouver Island and Vancouver, the mainland. And so I've seen all of those and a few of them that go a little bit further inland. I think years ago I was living in the mountains, a little bit inland from Vancouver, sort of past Whistler, if you know that area. And I had built a large labyrinth there, and I think that's the furthest east labyrinth that I've seen. And so I have some traveling to do, you know, because they go right to the Alberta border.
And so people have sent you pictures and descriptions, and that's how you've done it?
Yeah. It's, you know, with email and so on, it's just been great. So I can be talking to somebody and, you know, within a day I've got all their photographs, their information, and we've made incredible connections. And they've usually led me to another labyrinth, you know, going like, oh, no, not another one.
have you coordinated this with the Worldwide Labyrinth Locator?
I know that some of the people that I contacted and that I interviewed for my book, they didn't know about the Worldwide Labyrinth Locator, so I would ask them, you know, if they were interested in being on there, and with, you know, some of them said, yeah, I'll get on that. And so they found out that way and put their own labyrinths on. There are a few that I found through the Worldwide Labyrinth Locator, so I didn't know about them before. So that's been a very nice thread, you know, and certainly these labyrinths will all be available to go on to the Worldwide Labyrinth Locator if the owners of the places want to do that.
Seems like a lot of synchronicity between people recommending you to other labyrinths and you letting them know that this website existed, and like that. It's just sort of spreading.
It's been an incredible, I've never experienced this feeling of connection and community in my life, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And the, I guess the common interest is there. But it's at a level that's just remarkable. You know, it's like a family.
And so from the time that you decided to bring out the second edition to it actually going to print, how long has it been?
What did you mean by that?
Well, I mean you when you decided to create a second edition of this book, you know, and then from when you decided until now, how long has this process? How many? Has it been a year? A couple months? How long of a process has it been?
I would say it's been about 5 months.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was sometime in November I realized that, and I think it started happening slowly as the first one did. It just kind of grew, but for at least 3 months now I've been working on it every day. You know, that's I get up in the morning early, I'm on the computer the whole day.
And does this publishing house provide you with editors? Now I'm going to go into a little bit into the process for other people who might be interested about publishing their labyrinth books or whatever. If that's okay with you, I'm going to deviate a little bit here because this is interesting, I think, for people. Explain a little bit about the process. Did you just go out looking for a publishing house, or did somebody recommend that to you, or how did that work?
Initially, I did. Last year with the first edition, I put it out to several different publishing houses that I thought might be interested and were local. And, you know, a couple of them, one of them kept my book for a year. And that was before. And then, you know, said that it wasn't quite right for them. So I ended up self-publishing last time. And then I went through the process again about whether I wanted to even have a publisher. I approached the same publisher because they were interested, really interested. And I said, okay, now I've already done the book. You know, what do you think? It'd be a piece of cake for you to pick it up now, kind of thing. And I know that there's a huge market. And they've still got it. And in the meantime, you know, but I think, and what I learned through the process is that I want to self-publish, and so I am self-publishing, and more people are self-publishing because we can reach the same market faster, cheaper, you know, and be just as professional. So I'm absolutely sold on self-publishing.
And what does that mean exactly for you? I mean, what process did you have to go through?
I had to find out about printing, you know, the different companies of printing and what they require. I learned how to use InDesign, which is an Adobe program for publishing, for desktop publishing, and so that's been a whole learning curve that I've done with the second book. The first book I did just using my, you know, my Word program on the computer, but I was working with, you know, I had advice from a printing company, and they kept saying, "How do you? You just can't do a book on Word." And although I did the first one, I realized that I wanted to do, you know, have more control over the images because, of course, I must have 150 images and photographs in this book. And so placing those and having them not move around and having, you know, the kind of control that you need with this, that was the biggest learning curve for me, was actually learning how to use the program. And apart from that, it's of course there's marketing coming up. That's another whole ball game.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so that's of course a big one too. I have a bit of a entrepreneurial marketing kind of head, so it's another interesting game for me, you know. And I also have some friends that are going to coach me with that. I've created some really neat teams, and that's one thing I would suggest is don't try and do it on your own.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to do enough on your own anyway, but for instance, for my book cover, I had a duck dinner with lots of wine and invited some really savvy people over, and we brainstormed. And in one night, boom, it was just incredible.
That sounds like a brilliant idea. Very creative, and I can see that it would work out really well.
Yeah.
I mean, I know, I'm sure all of your friends want to support you, and what a great way to do that.
Yeah, it's really, really great. And even all the people that have the Labyrinth, they have all sorts of really interesting talents as well. And, of course, being Labyrinth people, they tend to be kind of in the creative, entrepreneurial wavelength, And so a lot of really great information has come from them as well.
And tell me, now I know that people who write don't do their own editing. Do you have a separate editing team as well?
I do, yeah. Mm-hmm. I have one incredible editor who is, lives on our boat in the West Indies. And we, I send her my documents every day through a, there are different ways to send your documents, PDFs. I change it into a PDF, put it in something that's called Dropbox. I know there are different systems, but we're using Dropbox. So in other words, you put your document into that, she gets access to it, and so it's completely secure, and it goes instantly. So we can be talking on the phone, and she's downloading my document, and we're talking about it. So it's pretty cool. I love technology.
On her boat in the West Indies. That's pretty. That is. That's,
yeah, rough.
That's very sweet.
She spends the winter down there.
Teaches
sailing off and on when she needs a little cash. And yeah.
That's great. Well, good luck with this. And speaking of marketing, though, I did want to ask. It seems to me, talking about this with you and thinking about it, I mean, yes, you want to get it into all of the bookstores that are local bookstores in Victoria and Vancouver and the surrounding towns, and I'm sure you already have a list of them in mind. But it would seem to me it would be something that the tourist bureau would also might find come in very handy. People now ask for that kind of thing. And when they stop on the main highways or wherever the tourist bureaus are, it would seem to me a good little good book to have there.
Yeah, I can see it there. I haven't talked to them. But when I got the idea for my first book, right away I could see it on the BC ferries, because they have great gift shops on the BC ferries, and there are so many of the ferries, and I just thought, wow, that's where I saw my book. So I actually started there. I phoned them and said, I'm going to write a book. How do I get it on the ferry? And they said, boy, you're brilliant. Most people write a book and then, figure out that at the end that they can't, do it. But on the ferries, they go through, certain distributors. They did tell me who not to publish with if I was going to self-publish, and that was really a key thing for me, because the very publisher that they would not accept a book from was the one I was choosing to go with. So that was, if you already know ahead of time where you want your book to end up, what shelves you want to see it on, talk to them first, Find out what distributors they're going to use and what they need from you, so that the doorway is open for you before you even start. And
that is a very key. That's a key point. Wow.
Yeah. So not that I can get it on the ferries, because they have such they demand that they have to sell so many thousand, and after 2 months, they will ship the books back. Well, I couldn't see that they were going to sell 2,000 of my books in, 2 months on a ferry. Mm-hmm. So, but they have all these kiosks and shops right at the ferry landing, and there's nothing stopping me from getting somebody to market my books there too, so.
Mm-hmm.
Not to worry.
Well, good luck. Good luck with that. It sounds Thanks. Exciting, and I'll look for it next time I'm up there.
Great.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about that website, Linda's Labyrinth. How did you come to be involved with this website? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, that was about 4 years ago now. I was actually visiting a friend in England, and he has the world's largest website on films on art. And at that time, it was becoming law to have accessible, you know, in other words, accessible to people with vision impairments and hearing impairments, to have a website in England. They were really cracking down, and they had a time limit on accessibility for websites. So I just happened to go to the Royal Institute for the Blind on an appointment with him to discuss it, and was fascinated. And he knew nothing about labyrinths, but I had brought him a labyrinth book, of course, one of Jeff Sayward's gorgeous books with all these photographs of, you know, labyrinths and mazes that surrounded him in England. And he was, being a sculptor and an artist, of course, he was fascinated right away with the idea of a labyrinth and wanted to start designing great, you know, installations all over the place. Mm-hmm. And so when I came back to Victoria after that, I went to the Canadian Institution for the Blind and started talking to them about how to make accessible websites and, you know, how we might be able to do it here to market his films. And just coincidentally, if you believe in coincidences, I was introduced to a fellow who was working there, he was one of the executives, and who is blind, Albert Ruel, and he was totally fascinated with the idea of labyrinths, and I don't know how I got into this discussion about labyrinths, but it usually comes up within about 5 minutes. And he called a few people together, and we met, and within a couple of weeks, we were having meetings about building a labyrinth that people who were blind or had vision impairments would be able to walk. And this group actually had their own agenda, which was one of the women is an advisor to our government and, you know, and key corporations about accessibility, and she's blind, Linda Bartram. And so her whole focus has been about educating people about being more aware and just creating more awareness about, you know, what we need to do to make things accessible for all people. So so we were having meetings hard and fast for at least a year, and came up with, we were working on a new design, and it included handrails on both sides of a 4-foot-wide path, and this would accommodate people who are, you know, using wheelchairs, baby carriages, you name it. And we were having real troubles. We had a design that I had run by Jeff Sayward and Robert Foray, and, you know, we were emailing back and forth, is this actually a labyrinth we're talking about, you know, and they said, oh, looks good, why don't you tweak it a little bit this way, you know, and so on. So they had a little bit of input there, too, that really supported us, and we, none of us could figure out how to get these handrails on both sides all the way to the center and how to change our design to it, you know, how to adapt it for that. And Linda came up with it, and she made, her initial design was made with these little wiki sticks, you know, little tactile, they're kind of like string that's waxy, so you can form it. And she did that on a piece of cardboard. Then she made one out of pipe cleaners. And then she made one out of Play-Doh that she made herself. And so we actually, and then an architect volunteered, a couple of landscape architects, and, you know, we all put our heads together and turned Linda's design into what it is now. So, so it ended up being Linda's Labyrinth because, you know, we were just so inspired that it took a blind person to figure out how to do it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, to really know what the challenges are. But that leads me to this question. There are principles of universal design that guided the design process for this unique labyrinth that guide anyone who is building for people with disabilities. Can you talk a little bit about that? Those principles?
Yeah, the principles of universal design, they were actually I have some information here. I was looking at the website. They're basically seven principles that not only do they make things, whether it is products or environments or communications, all those different things, but it's a universal standard now for architects to, I don't know if it's that they have to consider this now, but it's definitely a universal standard for accessibility. And definitely architects and landscape architects are, you know, doing their best to incorporate these. And I know that in the States, I think it was developed, and the website is from the University of North Carolina. And so it's the principles are not only for people with disabilities, but they're actually for developing things so that they're comfortable and attractive for everybody. And so you may be using, say, some salad tongs that, you know, are just an incredible Danish-looking design. But they have, and we wouldn't even notice that there's something special about them, but they have also been designed to work for somebody maybe who's, you know, having difficulty with their hands or motor skills or something like that. So so we, you know, especially because our team are focused on that, we wanted to make sure that we were taking all of that into account. And so one of the things is having tactile signage on the labyrinth, you know, and auditory things. So in other words, braille signs. We considered having a fountain at the entrance because, you know, it's directional, which means you need to be away from the wind because wind changes the sound from any direction. And a lot of really interesting considerations. And, of course, having a smooth surface and the approach and everything else.
And, you know, if you think about it, I mean, many, many, many labyrinths are wheelchair accessible if they're flat and painted on the on cement or tile or terrazzo. And that's never any problem. But when you add the a disability of the blindness, and to some degree deafness, but not as much as the blindness, really, because they, if without sight or a seeing eye dog or something, they can't follow the path. You have a whole another set of issues. I would imagine, and many of them are a combination. They're deaf and blind, or whatever. And so I wasn't, you know, not even thinking about it. I said, you know what, that's. It's true. What do people who are, unless they're led by someone else and they hold on to their arm or something and follow along that way, which I have seen blind people do, as a matter of fact, at Grace in San Francisco, how do they get around? So this is very interesting. So one of the things that was that you talked about was the handrails. You, on the website, it says that there a permanent location hasn't been found yet for
right.
this particular. Is that true still?
It is true. Yeah. Our provincial government actually asked us to do a presentation because they were interested. They had a piece of property right downtown. We wanted it central, of course, to make it accessible and. And so the provincial government was interested in us building this labyrinth. Our parks board there is a park that's in downtown Victoria that actually has what my favorite labyrinth. And they, because, you know, the grass gets brown in the summertime and the watering system wasn't working properly, they wanted us to rip it up. And I said, oh, my gosh, you know, that's the best one in town. You don't want to rip that up. But, you know, so... There, we did have support from those, you know, government officials and so on that really saw our purpose and wanted us to do it. And you know what it came down to is it did come down to the parks board, this park. And so we said, okay, if that's what we have to do, we'll do it. It's a great location and all that. And parks board said, okay, this is a go-ahead, but you have to take away the handrails. And because they said they're not attractive. And so one of our landscape architects said, look, we can deal with that. We can do, you know, pergolas and whatever and structures that, you know, people can't sleep behind or scare anybody or hide behind, you know. But they will kind of camouflage these all these railings, because it's a lot of railing. And but that particular park actually has a playground in it. So I came back and said, you know, playgrounds aren't really beautiful either. They're just a lot of iron railings. But they serve a purpose, and we're used to them. And but anyway, I went, you know, back to the team. We had a meeting and said, are we willing to forego these handrails to finally get our piece of land? And 100% it was no. That's our very point, you know, is that we're not going to sacrifice this because it doesn't make it, you know, up to the standards that we can approve. And, you know, the handrails were so crucial because, of course, you know, the members of the team have all been through labyrinths. They've, you know, we've used holding hands. They've used their dogs that they, you know, and their dogs are going, what the heck? You know, they're totally confused. You know, although Linda did say that she said, if I took Sydney through here enough times, that eventually he would get so that he could see the different color of the, you know, they were bricks. And slightly different color, but they were so vaguely different color that if it was a rainy day, you know, or fall, even I couldn't see the pattern. But she said he would get it after a while, but, you know, with training. So that's an interesting thing, too. But
it's almost like equine labyrinths. I mean, if you know, it's almost the same kind of principle. So, you know, maybe when they train dogs, if they can train them to do that, too, when they're training them as puppies, it's possible.
I think it would be neat to see that, really. But, you know, the blind members of the team said, you know what? The only time a blind person can completely, completely relax and actually enter into a meditation and enjoy themselves is if they have something to hold on to so that if they trip, if they turn their ankle on a stone or something, they are holding on to a handrail. And, you know, trying to do something with a curb and with a cane, which, of course, we started there. Okay, we'll have a 6-inch curb. And I know that Robert Frey has some designs. You know, we talked about that as well. So we had some conversations about other ways to do that. And, you know, what they said, using a cane is just not pleasant at all. It's a job. You know, it's work. Mm-hmm. You have to do that. You certainly have to be conscious all the time of where you're going and what you're doing. And the same with the dog. Because most of the time they're concerned about any danger to the dog. You know, they're more concerned about how the dog's doing than, you know, about how the dog is helping them. And so that was just, we weren't going to budge on those handrails. So we ended up just saying, maybe this project is completely ahead of its time. Maybe it's not the right time. What's the universe telling us here, you know? What's the message? Because we've put everything into it and we're all burned out now. Mm-hmm. And so we just kind of stepped back from it and said, you know, let's just take a breather. And then one day Linda, again, you know, our visionary, she said, why don't we create a website and overnight it will be accessible to the whole world. You know, we can just say, here are our plans. We've done a budget. We've, you know, completely worked out how to do it, you know, physically and to actually build a labyrinth. But on top of that, because I've been, every summer we have a festival of light in Victoria called Luminera, and I've been building the Linda's Labyrinth, and people love it. It so works, and people in wheelchairs have gone through it and said it's awesome. And so then the idea of, well, let's start, you know, putting it out there so people can do these for temporary labyrinths. And, yeah, they won't have the handrails, but it's a beginning. So that's what we did. We're just developing.
So what do they do? What do you do instead of the handrails?
Well, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay,
you know,
but the ones that you've made that are temporary don't have the handrails.
No, they don't. No, so they have to have something, you know, strong enough and hard enough on the ground, you know, for the walls lining the path, that a person with a cane or a person with a dog, that's going to be clear, that they can feel their way through, or their dog is, you know, can very clearly knows where the path is.
And so what did you do? What kind of wall did you put up there for you, the one that you've been making?
What we did was like deli containers with sand in them. So that's not the most sturdy thing that I would recommend, you know, but since this was mostly for, you know, 20,000 people, other people, that's what we did. And, of course, it's lanterns, so it's lit at night. But, you know, for something using, I don't know, pumpkins or something that's more solid than that would be far, far better. But that's what we've done, and with success.
Yeah, or some kind of planter. I mean, I know I've seen labyrinths that have herbal paths, you know, herbal lines that are flat, you know, plant lines. But maybe something even more, something like a low hedge, except low. That could be. I mean, that takes a little while for it to grow like that. But like the box hedges that are the maze that are the, you know. The mazes that you see in England could be done something like that, except low, and still be a labyrinth pattern.
Right, yeah. You know, well, certainly for a dog guide, you know, they can follow anything that's a clear path.
Right.
And so, I mean, I do have some friends that don't have dogs. You know, they strictly use their cane. So they need something hard to tap against.
Yeah. And how many temporary labyrinths have you, Linda's labyrinths, do you know, have been built?
Well, I don't know anybody else that's done it. We're just getting the website up now, actually. You know, it's still in the process of, we've just got the basic pages there, and but, you know, a lot of information needs to be added. So it's, and this only happened last month. So, yeah, so it's all very new, and kind of being reborn after we were ready to put it on the shelf and forget about it for a while.
Well, I think it's just brilliant, and I mean, I'm envisioning all sorts of interesting things you could make the railings out of that are tactile and have some sensory feel to them that might be very interesting to actually for people, you know, not just blind people, but also that it will provide a sense of what it is to be blind for sighted people. And it's, nobody really understands that, which would be fantastic, you know, walk a mile in my shoes kind of thing. So it would be a hugely learning and experience, eye-opening experience, I think, for sighted people as well. We actually have a caller, a fellow Canadian, it looks like. I see the Canadian flag there. Let me just ask you, you gave one of the concurrent workshop presentations for the 2009 Labyrinth Society Convention. Are you planning to do another one for this year's?
Actually, Christiana, I didn't do one this year there.
Oh, I thought you did.
Yeah, but I would really love to do one. Yeah, so.
I know you were there and very active. And I was, but I, you know, I didn't look on the workshop list. So, are you thinking about doing one for this year's?
Well, you know, since you mentioned it, now I'm thinking about it. So, yeah, you never know. I think it's a really great idea.
Yeah, and especially, doing a full disability, Linda's Labyrinth. I mean, there's so many people who I'm sure would be willing to help, who would find it especially Ben Nicholson, who's one of the main presenters and who is avidly involved. Hello?
Yep.
Are you there?
I'm still here.
Oh, that was funny. Something strange happened. So do you have any other labyrinth activities you'd like to talk about? And then we'll get this person on.
Yeah, well, let's see other labyrinth activities. There's something really inspiring is that there's a town up island from me, Duncan, and that's a really hot spot for labyrinths, and I always wondered about that. Now, it's an old native community, so there's a lot of other, you know, spirituality around there, but May is Cancer Month, and so there's a group up there that what they're doing is they're actually promoting labyrinth walking as part of their, you know, Cancer Month. So they're having several labyrinths, temporary labyrinths built, but they're also giving out information on the labyrinths that are in the local area. And Carol Matthews, who wrote the book, Reflections on the C Word, at the center of the cancer labyrinth. And that little book is a beautiful little book that's very inspiring, not depressing as you would think, but you know, about her journey with walking labyrinths as her healing process through cancer. And so she's going to be talking, and that's just fabulous. And of course, now they want to build a permanent labyrinth at the hospice there. So that's
and this
that's,
is May
of,
is cancer month or
May is cancer
April
month. May is cancer month up here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, oh, and Duncan, British Columbia. So is that up on the islands, up on the Sunshine Coast?
Yeah, no, it's on Vancouver Island, and it's about an hour north of Victoria. So just
okay,
a little run up the island. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's get this other person on. I don't know who it is,
yeah,
so let me get this person on right now. Hello, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, welcome to Labyrinth in the News. Who am I talking to?
My name is Les.
Les, hi, Les. How are you today?
I'm good. And it's Christiana, is it?
Yes.
Okay, hi. I know I've been sort of communicating with Arianna through email. I do temporary labyrinths, and I do them on the beach. What I do is I draw them at low tide on the beach between the high and low tide lines. Mm-hmm. And I just draw them around, say, in Vancouver, British Columbia, on the beaches, say Sunset Beach and different beaches like that. So that's my process, and I'm just curious. You know, I haven't been listening to what else you guys have been talking about, so I just heard the temporary labyrinth, so I just wanted to say that's something I do. And, yeah, I've been walking a labyrinth for a while and drawing them, and, yeah, I don't know what else to really say except I support the use of labyrinths, certainly as well with different kinds of a disease process such as cancer. I think you can walk your way through different things in life, and maybe that's what people do when they walk a labyrinth and experience a disease. I don't know. Anyway,
do you do your own designs on the beach, or do you do ones that you've seen in books? Do you do like the classical or the shark style or whatever?
I do the medieval, so it's the classical. I don't. What I've done is I've taken the actual measurements of the chart design that I borrowed from the design, or the measurements I borrowed from Robert Ferry, and I increased them by a phi or 1.6 just because they're a little bit larger on the beach. The paths then to walk in the labyrinth, it becomes a little bit bigger, and on the beach as well to walk. And but I use a medieval design, and it's about 70 feet in diameter when I draw them.
Ariane, do you know these beaches that he's talking about?
I do, yeah. And I've seen amazing, there's a woman in Vancouver, Christina Hatful, and she's a photographer. She's taken over 4,000 photographs of Les's. In fact, he's in my book. So, unfortunately, Les, I didn't have room to put any photographs in. I wish I could have put a bunch of them in, but... yeah, they're quite remarkable, and those are fabulous beaches. They're all around the downtown area, but I think that Les is also, you know, I've heard that he's done them at a school, at a technical college or something, and then they had a what do they call it when they don't drive, a drive-free day or car-free day?
Car-free day, yes.
Yeah, didn't you do one there?
Yeah, I did that on Commercial Drive in Vancouver. They had a car-free day where so the streets are closed down and people just came and kind of played on the street. And for me, playing on the street was to just draw a labyrinth and just see how people would maybe interact with the labyrinth on the street. Kids loved it. They ran it. And, yeah, I've also drawn it I've drawn it on a stage at a theater, in a theater at a school for high school students who were looking at the... Theseus myth and the Minotaur myth.
Oh, right, yes.
Mm-hmm. So
it was the Minotaur at the center of the labyrinth?
Yeah, and so the kids
yes.
were reading that in school, so I drew a labyrinth for them to sort of have, I guess, an existential experience to walk the labyrinth that they were studying in the book at school. And I think it was an English class or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
you for calling in and giving us and telling us a little bit about this. Well,
yeah.
So I'll have to look for it in the book.
Okay.
And thank you both for both. We're out of time, and thank you both so much for joining me today, and many, many blessings on your paths.
Thank you, Christiana. It's been fun. Happy journey.
Okay, you too. You've been listening to Labyrinth in the News in the Life category on blogtalkradio.com with your host, Christiana. Please join me April 5th when my guest will be Ian Brioch, Welsh thespian, experiential artist, and creator of a permanent labyrinth installation in theater, Caerdroecha, on the Welsh coast. Join us as we discuss the labyrinth is theater. Have a blessed week in Lachaise.